What would it be? Oh, I see what you mean. You're asking, would the Filipinos support an American guerrilla operation? Pickering nodded. Fleming, over the years, you've spent as much time in the Philippines as I have. I'm asking you. Well, unless American officers did something really stupid, and that's a real possibility, I think 75%, 85% of the Filipinos would help an American guerrilla operation. Pickering nodded. Are you going to tell me why you're interested in this? Stecker asked. There's a chap on Mindanao, a reserve officer who chose not to surrender. His name is Wendell Fertig. He's trying to set up a guerrilla operation.
And?
We know he's got some Marines with him. That seems to make it our business. We're looking into what, if anything, we can do for him, and what, if any, good he can really do against the Japs.
Who's we?
Frank Knox, Chester Nimitz, and me. El Supremo doesn't seem to be at all interested.
There aren't very many people around who can so casually refer to the Secretary of the Navy and the Commander-in-Chief Pacific by their first names, or refer, with obviously amused affection, to General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, as El Supremo. I probably should have insisted on obeying my orders, but the truth is, I'm glad he's going to keep this Colonel Mitchell off my back. And in the final analysis, Flem Pickering is the senior Marine officer around here. I really don't have any choice.
Lieutenant Hart returned to the kitchen carrying a bottle of Courvoisier cognac and two crystal cognac snifters. "Colonel Mitchell's compliments, sir," he said. "He asked me to tell you that he stands ready to render any assistance to Colonel Stecker requested." Pickering snorted. "Shall I pour, sir?" Hart said, smiling. "Those snifters are for officers and gentlemen, Hart," Pickering said. "At the moment, what you have is just a couple of badly hung-over old Marines. Just pour about an inch of that stuff into our coffee, will you please?" Top Secret, Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Navy Department, Washington, D.C. Via special channel, duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. For Colonel F. L. Rickaby, USMC Office of Management Analysis. Brisbane, Australia. Monday, 9 November, 1942. Dear Fritz, I don't know if you've heard or not, but Lieutenant Colonel Jack NMI Stecker is here in Brisbane. He went to Staff Sergeant Koffler's wedding with me, as a matter of fact, and is at the moment moving his stuff from the Army BOQ into my house. He's here to set up facilities for the 1st MARDIV when they are relieved from Guadalcanal and brought here for rehabilitation and refitting. According to Stecker, they are in really bad physical shape. Almost everybody has malaria. Stecker was relieved of his command of 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, and is now officially assigned to SWEPO in some sort of vaguely defined billet. I am unable to believe he was relieved for cause, and strongly suspect that it is the Professional Officer Corps pushing aside a reservist up from the ranks Mustang to give the command to one of their own. I can't imagine why General Vandegrift permitted this to happen, but it has happened, and it may be a blessing in disguise for us. I had a talk with Stecker after the wedding, and it came out that he has had extensive experience with guerrilla operations in the Banana Republics, especially Nicaragua, between the wars. It seems to me that if you know how to fight against guerrillas, it would follow that you know how to fight as a guerrilla, and certainly to knowledgeably evaluate how someone else is set up and equipped to fight as guerrillas. I haven't said anything to him yet, but I know him well enough to know that he would rather be doing something either with or for this fellow Fertig on Mindanao than arranging tours of picturesque Australia or USO shows, which is what the Corps wants him to do now. And there is no question in my mind that his contribution to this effort would be of much greater value than what he is doing now. So I want him transferred to us with a caveat. He has already suffered enough humiliation. God damn it, he has the Medal of Honor. How could they do this to him? As it is, so I want you to take every precaution to make sure there is no scuttlebutt circulating that he has been further demoted by his assignment to us. Do it as quickly as you can, and I think you had better send McCoy over here, too, as quickly as that can be arranged. I think the sooner we get somebody with Captain General Fertig, the better. Regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General USMCR, Top Secret. 2. Naval Air Transport Station, Brisbane, Australia. 0455 hours, 14 November, 1942. First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR, was not in a very good mood when the consolidated PB-2Y-3 Coronado splashed down in Brisbane Harbor. A drenching in the whaleboat that carried him ashore made his mood worse, and when he saw Second Lieutenant George F. Hart, USMCR, standing on the wharf, the golden cords of an aide-de-camp hanging from his epaulettes, his mood grew worse still. The son of a bitch hasn't been in the Corps long enough to be a goddamned corporal, and there he stands in an officer's uniform. The flight from Pearl Harbor in the huge, four-engined flying boat was long and rough. A Medical Corps lieutenant commander got airsick 30 minutes out of Pearl, threw up what looked like the remnants of an entire Hawaiian luau and 2 quarts of beer all over himself and the deck, and then spent the rest of the flight either moaning, dry heaving, or rubbing his vomit-soaked uniform in McCoy's face as he made his way every 15 minutes to the head. Before McCoy boarded the Coronado at Pearl Harbor, he had run into a zealous Navy lieutenant who wouldn't let him get on the airplane, 5A priority or not, until his shot record was up to date. McCoy's shot record recorded that he had been injected with every inoculation against every disease known to the Navy Medical Corps. The record itself, however, was in Washington. Ed Sessions had suggested that since he was going to be around for a while, it would make sense to have the contents of the shot record incorporated into all his official records. Sessions hadn't gotten it back to him when the hurry-up call from General Pickering to go to Brisbane came in. The idiot at Pearl actually wanted to give him the entire series of inoculations again, but a medical lieutenant commander at the hospital was more reasonable. He gave McCoy credit for all the shots given Marines in the States, but insisted that McCoy take the series prescribed for people headed for the Pacific and or Southwest Pacific Ocean areas, despite McCoy's protestations that he had been in Australia only the month before and had had the shots then. So he suffered from the side effects of half a dozen inoculations, including a left buttock that felt as if it had been bitten by a poisonous snake. He couldn't sit on his sore left buttock without pain, and there was no way on the pipe and cloth seats of the Coronado to avoid sitting on it. Before the Coronado took off from Pearl Harbor, there was a long flight on an Army Air Corps B-17 Flying Fortress from San Francisco. He spent that flight making himself as comfortable as possible on a pile of mail sacks. McCoy climbed out of the whaleboat and then, carrying his bag, made his way up the stone steps cut into the wharf. Second Lieutenant Hart saluted First Lieutenant McCoy. There was nothing wrong with the salute. It was crisp and accompanied by a smile. "Give me your bag, Mr. McCoy," Hart said. "You must be a little weary." McCoy returned Hart's salute and handed over his bag. Hart picked it up effortlessly. "The son of a bitch really has a build." And then gestured down the wharf. McCoy looked and saw General Pickering's Studebaker staff car. "You're cleared through the arrival processing, Mr. McCoy," Hart said. "The general arranged it." "Thank you," McCoy said, and started walking toward the Studebaker. There's nothing really wrong with Hart. He didn't ask for that gold bar. And for that matter, I'm the guy who recruited him for General Pickering from Paris Island. And, oh shit, I know for a fact he's not a candy ass. When I told him I was going to leave him alone overnight on the beach at Buka, all he said was, "Okay." That took balls. What's wrong around here, McCoy, is you. You've got a bad case of candy ass yourself.
It isn't fair that I'm back here.
I don't think the discipline of the entire Marine Corps would collapse if you called me Ken, George.
Well, that would presume I have forgiven you for leaving me on that beach all by my lonesome, Mr. McCoy. I'm not quite at that point yet. Well, in that case, go fuck yourself, Mr. Hart.
Hey, before I forget it, when you see Koffler and he thanks you for his wedding present, just say, you're welcome. You bought him a wedding present and said it was from me? 2 sets of pajamas from the officer's sales store. How much?
Well, now that you mention it, $4.50 each, plus 2 bits to have the fly sewn shut on the brides. 9 1/4.
McCoy stopped, took out his wallet, and handed Hart a $10 bill.
Thanks, George, he said, and then thought aloud. How did you know you'd get your money back? You ever hear what they say about bad pennies? They keep turning up?
In other words, you didn't. You're really a nice guy, Hart.
How's the general? McCoy asked. Ask him yourself, Hart said, and effortlessly waved McCoy's bag toward the Studebaker.
Brigadier General Fleming W. Pickering was in the process of stepping out of the front passenger seat.
Jesus Christ, McCoy muttered. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. What's he doing up at this hour?
I think he wants to talk to you before you get out to Water Lily, Hart said. As a matter of fact, I know he does. He told me. I'd welcome you to Australia, Ken, General Pickering said as McCoy came near. But I'm afraid you'd throw something at me. Sorry about this. It was necessary.
McCoy saluted crisply.
Good morning, sir.
How was the flight?
I've had better, sir, McCoy said.
You all right?
You're walking funny.
I had a shot where I sit, sir. It's a little sore. I'll be all right.
Get in the back, Ken, Pickering said. I want to talk to you before we get to the cottage.
Aye, aye, sir.
George, take 20 minutes or so to drive us home.
Aye, aye, sir.
I didn't think. Ken, are you hungry?
I'm all right, sir.
Somehow I suspect that's not the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
I'm all right, sir. I can wait until we get to the cottage.
If you're sure, Pickering said doubtfully, I'd really like to get this out of the way.
I'm all right, sir, McCoy repeated.
Okay, then get in.
A general officer is holding the door for me, McCoy thought.
There were 2 reminders that Pickering was a general officer. First, when Hart removed the covers from the Red Star general officer's plates on the car, and again when they passed the guard at the gate to the Navy base, he started saluting the car long before they reached the guard shack. Pickering returned the guard's salute casually, then extended a cigar case to McCoy. McCoy took one.
Thank you, sir.
Cuban, Pickering said.
The Pacific Commerce called here. Unfortunately for her master, I remembered he was a cigar smoker. I pulled rank on him and relieved him of his stock. So he smokes his thumb on the long voyage to San Francisco, and you and I and El Supremo have something to smoke.
Typical General Pickering. If he got cigars from one of his ships, it was because he asked for them politely, not demanded them, and the captain gave him all he had, not so much because Pickering owned Pacific and Far East shipping, but because the captain, like everybody else I've ever known who works for him, would give him the shirt off his back.
Two questions, Ken, Pickering said. How would you feel about going back to the Philippines? I mean, by rubber boat off a submarine.
I'm a Marine, sir. I go where I'm ordered. That's not what I asked.
Every time I start feeling sorry for myself, sir, I remind myself I'm not on Guadalcanal living in the mud with people trying to kill me.
Are you feeling sorry for yourself right now?
I thought I was going to have 4 or 5 months in the States.
With Ernie, you mean, Pickering said. It was not a question.
How is she?
Just fine, sir.
She was fine when she put me on the plane, but when Ed Sessions showed up at her apartment with my plane tickets, she lost it. I'd never seen her cry before.
Pickering grunted.
You coming back must have been tough on her, but she's a tough little lady.
You didn't see her cry.
Yes, sir, she is. I have a package for you. It's in my bag from Mr. Sage. I was going to send it with an officer courier, but then...
How do you get along with him?
If I were him, I don't think I'd like me either. Ernie deserves better than this, than me. Better than this,
maybe. But if I had a daughter, I wouldn't be laying barbed wire to keep you away from her. McCoy chuckled.
Thank you, sir.
Second question. How do you get along with Colonel Jack Stecker?
What kind of a question is that? How do I get along with him? He's a light colonel, and I'm a first lieutenant. He'll tell me what to do, and I will do it.
Colonel Stecker is a fine Marine, sir.
And he was a fine buck sergeant in the First World War. My question was, how do you get along with him?
I say, aye, aye, sir, to him a lot.
Am I hearing he's a fine Marine, but I don't like him?
No, sir,
McCoy replied, quickly and sincerely. Does the name Fertig mean anything to you?
He didn't surrender in the Philippines? McCoy asked.
Right. I picked up on a little about him in Washington, McCoy said. Right, he's a reserve army officer, a captain.
The way I heard it, he's a light bird,
McCoy thought, but said nothing. Who has a radio, an obsolete code machine, and says he is establishing a guerrilla force. He's got some people with him, including some Marines. El Supremo is a little embarrassed about him. After he announced there was absolutely no possibility of guerrilla activity in the Philippines, this fellow Fertig shows up. But Nimitz, and more important, Leahy and Frank Knox think he may have potential.
Yes, sir.
What I want to do is send you and Jack Stecker into the Philippines, specifically onto Mindanao. You'll take Fertig some supplies, a radio, some codes, medicine, small arms, etc.
Aye, aye, sir.
But your primary mission will be to evaluate him, the people around him, and his, their, potential. Between you and Stecker, I think you have the experience and the knowledge to come up with some valid answers.
The last poop I had was that Eighth and I was giving Colonel Rickaby a bad time about transferring Stecker to management analysis. Did they finally get off their fat asses?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to have Stecker transferred.
What's he doing? Reading my mind?
To us. I asked for him some time ago, got no response, and finally had enough of the feet dragging at 8th and I and went right to Frank Knox.
Well, that ought to get them off their fat asses. But they'll have their knives out for you and Stecker, and anybody connected with either one of you.
Yes, sir.
Unfortunately, until he is transferred to us, he's here in Australia to set up the 1st Marine Division's refitting and rehabilitation when they're relieved from Guadalcanal. I can't involve him officially. As far as that goes, I haven't even asked him if he'd be willing to go. But I've been pumping his brain and his experience, and felt as trying to get an Aussie submarine to take you and the supplies. If that falls through, I think I can get one from the Navy, from Nimitz. When you speak with Stecker, stay off the subject of him going with you.
Aye, aye, sir.
How soon do you think you could be ready to go?
Did you say, sir, that Colonel Stecker's arranged for the supplies you want me to take in?
They're available on 24 hours' notice.
I don't want to go to the goddamned Philippines. What I want to do is go home and put my arms around Ernie and tell her I'm back and I'm going to be there a while.
Then, if we have an Aussie submarine, we can go in 24 hours, sir, McCoy said, and then raised his voice. Hey, George! You want to go for another rubber boat ride?
No, sir. Thank you very much. Just the same, sir.
George can't go, Pickering said, for reasons I can't tell you.
Which means that Hart now has one of these magic clearances I'm not supposed to know about. Just got it. He couldn't have gone along on the Buka operation if he had had a magic clearance. Banning wouldn't have gone with me to the Gobi Desert, and Hart can't go with me to the Philippines. People with magic clearances are not expendable. Stecker and I don't have them, so we are expendable. How about giving me a magic clearance, General, so I can't do crap like this? And while you're at it, how about throwing in one for Colonel Stecker?
Yes, sir.
It won't be in 24 hours, obviously, Pickering said. But don't sign any long-term leases, Ken.
Aye, aye, sir.
Take us home, George, General Pickering ordered. We're done.
Aye, aye, sir.
You sure you don't want to change your mind, George? McCoy asked. Maybe this time you won't fall out of the boat.
Once is enough. Thank you just the same for that sort of thing, Hart said.
Ken, I said George can't go, Pickering said.
I'm just pulling his chain, sir.
Three. Water Lily Cottage, Brisbane, Australia. 0605 hours, 14 November, 1942. Two U.S. Army Jeeps, a Jeep with USMC markings, and a 1938 Jaguar drophead coupe were parked in front of the cottage when Hart pulled the Studebaker up in front of the wide porch that circled the rambling frame building. Without thinking consciously about it, McCoy identified the vehicles and concluded that just about everybody who lived in Water Lily Cottage was home. The Jaguar was the General's personal vehicle, made available to him by its owner, an Australian executive of Pacific and Far East Shipping Corporation. "One of the world's great automobiles," Pickering often declared, "presuming you can get the son of a bitch to start, and if you don't mind a leaking roof." The Marine Corps Jeep was probably Colonel Stecker's. The U.S. Army Jeeps, which carried the bumper markings of the Sweepo motor pool, were assigned for the use of the dungeon dwellers. The dungeon, more formally known as the Sweepo Cryptographic Room, was so called because it was located in the sub-basement of the Supreme Headquarters Sweepo building, behind a creaking steel door and with walls that oozed condensation. Within the cryptographic room, which was actually a suite, there was another room behind another heavy, always locked steel door. It was a cryptographic section guarding one of the most closely held and vitally important secrets of the war, which went by the code name Magic. Navy cryptographers at the Pearl Harbor, Territory of Hawaii, Navy base had broken many, by no means all, of the Japanese Imperial General Staff and Imperial Navy codes. Not only was the very fact that the codes had been broken classified top secret, but access to intercepted and decrypted messages was limited to a very few people, personally approved by the Chief of Staff to the Commander-in-Chief, Admiral William Leahy, or by the President himself. The Commander-in-Chief Pacific, Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, and the Supreme Commander, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, General Douglas MacArthur, were on the list. So were Brigadier General Fleming Pickering, USMCR, and Colonel F. L. Rickaby of the Office of Management Analysis. McCoy was assigned to the Office of Management Analysis after he was commissioned, and in the course of events learned more than he had any right to know about magic. He did not consciously seek this knowledge, but it was not difficult for him to pick up a fact here and a fact there. It would have been difficult or impossible for him not to, and assemble a rather clear picture of magic and of how USMC Special Detachment 16, the official unit description for management analysis personnel stationed in Australia, were involved with it. It was clear to McCoy that Major Han Song Do, Signal Corps, USA, on temporary duty with Detachment 16, and Second Lieutenant John Marston Moore, USMCR, were far more than a pair of cryptographic officers assigned to handle routine, classified material for Sweepo. Han, a Korean-American from Hawaii, was not only absolutely fluent in Japanese, but held a Ph.D. in mathematics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Moore was born in Japan to missionary parents, studied at the University of Tokyo, and was equally fluent in Japanese. At least once a day, sometimes more often, one or the other of them had a private session with General Douglas MacArthur, and sometimes his intelligence officer, Brigadier General Charles Willoughby. They went to these meetings, without leaving the Sweepo headquarters building, with a briefcase chained to their wrists and carrying .45 caliber pistols under their uniform tunics. Hence, carrying something really secret. What sort of secrets? Secrets that could not be shared with the other general officers at Sweepo. Secrets that had to be handled with even greater care than other top-secret material coming into Sweepo, under a classification, magic, that no one was even supposed to talk about. Han was a mathematician. Mathematicians broke codes. Han and Moore were Japanese linguists. By definition, Japanese linguists dealt with the translation of Japanese. In other words, McCoy correctly concluded, Han and Moore were reading, translating, interpreting some kind of highly classified Japanese material. Why highly classified? There would be no strict security involved if all they were doing was reading captured Japanese documents. The more people who knew what the Japanese were doing and thinking, the better. Unless, perhaps, they were reading intercepted Japanese encrypted radio messages and didn't want the Japanese to know that their code was broken. That would explain a good many things. Why so few people had access to magic material. Why anyone who had knowledge of magic was absolutely forbidden to go anywhere where there was any chance at all of their falling into Japanese hands. Major Han Song-du, a very large man, tall, muscular, and heavy-set, was sitting sprawled on a couch in the living room when General Pickering and Lieutenants McCoy and Hart walked in.
"Welcome home, Ken," he said.
He had a thick Boston accent. He came off the couch with surprising grace for his bulk and offered his hand. His left hand, McCoy noticed, held a briefcase from which a chain led to his wrist.
"Thank you, sir," McCoy said. "Now that you have paid due and appropriate homage to my new and exalted rank, you may revert to calling me Pluto," Han said.
"I didn't know Army Field Grade officers got up at this time of the morning," McCoy said.
"I haven't been to bed," Pluto said, and then looked at Pickering. "When you have a moment, sir?"
"I could have come to the dungeon," Pickering said. They both looked at McCoy.
"Whatever is in Pluto's briefcase is none of my business."
"Why don't you show Ken where he'll be sleeping?" Pickering said to Hart.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Lieutenant Colonel Jack N.M.I. Stecker was sitting in one of the wicker armchairs in the bedroom when McCoy came out of the bathroom, a towel around his waist.
"You do get around, Lieutenant, don't you?" Stecker said, smiling. "You're living proof that if you join the Corps, you really will see the world."
"Good morning, sir."
"How are you, Ken?"
Stecker asked, offering his hand without rising out of the chair.
"The General said you had some trouble with shots?"
"They gave me one in the tail. I have no idea what it was."
"You all right? Fever? Sweaty? Sick to your stomach?"
"Just a sore tail," McCoy said, touched at Stecker's concern. "The bath made it better."
"It's been a long time since I've had a bath," McCoy thought as he soaked in the large old-fashioned tub, as opposed to a shower. Here, he had no choice. The showerhead was at the end of a long, flexible cable. The moment he lifted it from its cradle and turned it on, it developed a powerful leak, spraying water on the ceiling and over the top of the shower curtain. He quickly turned it off, gave in to the inevitable, and took a bath. Stecker nodded, then pointed to a table set against the wall. McCoy saw there a silver coffee service and a napkin-covered tray.
"I see you live pretty well around here," Stecker said.
"I'm a nice guy. I'm entitled," McCoy said.
"I'm having a little trouble believing how well," Stecker said. "Under the napkin, your choice of breakfast rolls. And there's real cream in that pitcher. And if you want, for example, ham and eggs, fresh eggs, all you have to do is push that doorbell and someone will come and ask you if you want them over easy or sunny side up."
"Colonel," McCoy said, smiling, "this is what they call the lap of luxury. You'd be surprised how easy it is to get used to."
Stecker chuckled.
"You want some breakfast, Ken?"
"I'd like some coffee," McCoy said, then walked to the table and poured two cups of coffee, carrying one of them to Stecker.
"The General said something about you setting up for the 1st Division coming here from the canal?" McCoy asked, but it was a statement.
"That's what I'm here for," Stecker said. "But since the division's movement here is still classified, there's not really much I can do. And since the Army's handling the major logistics, quarters and rations, I really don't know what the hell I'm supposed to be doing."
"He also told me you were setting up my little operation," McCoy said.
He's decided I'm some sort of an expert on guerrilla operations, which I am not. But what I've been doing is coming up with the supplies, medicine, small arms, and ammo I think you should take with you. But it's your show, McCoy. I'm just trying to make myself useful. If you don't like what I'm suggesting or you want something else, Colonel, I know less about guerrilla operations than anybody I know. My expertise here is in paddling rubber boats, which is a lot harder than it looks." "Hart told me," Stecker said, laughing, and then, growing serious,
"I wanted to talk to you about that, about how we pack the stuff you'll be taking with you."
"In small packages, nothing that can't be handled by one man," McCoy said. "Getting the stuff off the submarine into a rubber boat is tough, and then getting it out of the boat and onto land is harder.
Ideally, small, waterproof packages that can be handled by one man, and that float. Koffler's working on something that may help. You know what plastic is?
McCoy shook his head, no.
I was surprised to hear that Koffler's out of the hospital. He's back on duty?
Back on duty and married. I heard about him getting married, McCoy replied.
The last time I saw him, he looked like death warmed over, and not old enough to even think about getting married.
He's the youngest staff sergeant I ever saw, Stecker said.
General Pickering promoted him so he'd be eligible to get married. Anyway, his wife has been giving him lots of tender, loving care. Howard's still pretty weak. Apparently, the medicine they give to kill intestinal and blood parasites is some kind of poison.
Poisons, plural.
It hit Howard harder than it hit Koffler.
Howard had a nurse girlfriend, McCoy said, making it a question.
He still does, according to Major Hahn. But they decided not to get married because the minute they do, she gets shipped home.
Why?
Some regulation. It's apparently designed to keep innocent Marines from the clutches of lonely nurses. But speaking of Mrs. Koffler, you're having dinner with them.
What?
She wants to show her appreciation to you and Hart for getting him off Buka.
I'll pass, thank you, Colonel.
Is there any reason you couldn't go tonight? I know the General has nothing for you to do then, and he told me he thought a home-cooked meal would be good for you.
That sounds like an order.
The General feels sorry for her.
McCoy's eyebrows rose in question.
You don't know the story?
McCoy shook his head, no.
According to the General, Koffler got her in the family way the night before they dropped him on Buka, Stecker said. That happened to be the night they had a memorial service for her husband, who was killed in Africa.
McCoy's eyebrows rose again, but he said nothing, waiting for Stecker to go on.
They kicked her out of the Royal Navy.
Royal Australian Navy, McCoy corrected him, thinking out loud.
When they learned she was pregnant, and her family has... Ken, her father wouldn't even come to the wedding. They've just about kicked her out of the family. That's pretty vicious. She's a nice girl, and the General likes her.
Let the General have dinner with her.
He already has. I wasn't the only one on the Buka operation. Hart was there. God, Pick Pickering was flying the airplane that picked us up, he and Charlie Galloway. Young Pickering is somewhere in the States. Galloway is in Hawaii. Hart and you are here, and the General thinks a good home-cooked Aussie meal would do all of you some good.
What, roast kangaroo?
I knew you would be delighted, Stecker said.
What were you saying about Koffler and...
What did you say? Plastic.
What is it?
Have you seen the airtight, waterproof stuff they're packaging equipment in lately?
McCoy shook his head helplessly.
That aluminum-backed tar paper? No, not that. Plastic. Hart will tell you all about it over dinner. It'll give you something to talk about.
4. Apartment 3C, the Amherst Apartments, Brisbane, Australia. 1915 hours, 14 November, 1942. Despite a map General Pickering had drawn for him, it took McCoy a long time to find the Amherst Apartments, a four-story brick building overlooking the harbor. They were driving the Studebaker President.
Not bad for a 19-year-old staff sergeant, McCoy said to Second Lieutenant George F. Hart, USMCR, as they climbed the stairs to the third floor.
Jealous?
Yeah, I guess I am, McCoy said.
Just for the record, Hart said as McCoy reached out to punch the doorbell.
I was devoutly hoping you'd be able to talk us out of this.
Just smile and be nice, McCoy replied.
The doorbell, when pushed, caused a clang. A moment later, the door was opened by Staff Sergeant Stephen M. Koffler, USMCR. Sergeant Koffler was 5 feet 7 inches tall, weighed approximately 130 pounds, and looked 2 years younger than his 19 years.
Good evening, gentlemen, he said, clearly having rehearsed his opening remarks. Please come in.
Good evening, Sergeant Koffler, McCoy said, and thrust a brown paper bag at him. It contained a bottle of famous grouse scotch.
How are you, Steve?
Hart said, and thrust a somewhat larger brown paper bag at him.
It contained two bottles of
a damned nice Aussie Cabernet Sauvignon, as General Pickering said when he intercepted the two of them leaving Water Lily Cottage and handed them both bags.
Welcome, Mrs. Daphne Koffler said from behind her husband. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us, McCoy said.
Even in her flat shoes, Mrs. Koffler was an inch taller than her husband. She had hazel eyes and peaches and cream skin. She wore her light brown hair done up in a bun at her neck, and she wore only a light lipstick as makeup.
I especially wanted, to thank you for what you did for Steve, for the both of us.
For the three of us, Koffler chimed in. His wife blushed. McCoy found himself looking at Mrs. Koffler's belly. To his embarrassment, she was just starting to show.
That's not necessary, McCoy said.
If you hadn't gone to Buka, he'd probably be dead, Daphne Koffler said. And God only knows what would have happened to me and the baby.
Christ, she sounds like Ernie, says exactly what's on her mind, and looks you right in the eye when she says it.
We're Marines, Mrs. Koffler, McCoy said. We go where we're sent. Steve was sent to Buka, and Hart and I were sent in to get him out. No thanks are necessary.
Indulge me, she said. Let me say thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Now, can we change the subject? Hart told me we're going to have roast kangaroo. Is that true?
No, of course it's not. We're having steak. Pluto brought some from the officer's mess.
McCoy was momentarily taken aback by the casual reference to Major Han Song-du, and then he remembered Koffler's pregnant wife was in contact with Pluto as an assistant to Commander Felt long before he was.
Why don't we have a drink?
Staff Sergeant Koffler said. McCoy saw that Mrs. Koffler looked a little uneasy.
She knows what's going to happen. The boy sergeant is going to get plastered. I wonder how they got together. Christ, she's older than he is, more sophisticated. What the hell did she see in him?
What the hell does Ernie see in me?
I know two things for sure. Whatever the reason she let him went to bed with him the night before he went to Buka, it's not because she's a slut. This is a nice girl. And her look just now when he offered the drink was of concern for him. She loves him.
Why am I surprised? Because he looks like a high school cheerleader?
The drinks Staff Sergeant Koffler provided for his guests were about twice as strong as they should have been.
Koffler, would you break this one into two or three? McCoy asked. I would like to be sober when I eat.
Mrs. Koffler looked at McCoy with appreciation. Staff Sergeant Koffler looked at him in embarrassment, as if he had committed a terrible social blunder.
Koffler, I just got here, McCoy said. It was a long trip, and Colonel Stecker had me running all day. I can't handle much liquor when I'm tired.
I was out stealing plastic from the army all day, Koffler said.
What's plastic? McCoy asked.
I don't know what the hell it's made of, but the army is wrapping stuff in it. It's waterproof and airtight, just what you need for the stuff you're going to take into the Philippines.
He went into the kitchen carrying McCoy's glass.
Jesus Christ. I don't know how this Fairtig operation is classified, but it's at least secret, and probably top secret. It should not be casually introduced into conversation. Well, I doubt if Mrs. Koffler will spread it among the girls over coffee. I'll have a word with him later about talking too much, if he's sober enough later to listen.
Koffler returned with a drink.
I hope this is better, he said, and turned to Hart. Can I make yours weaker, Lieutenant?
I'll just go slow, Hart said. Tell me about plastic, McCoy said.
Well, it looks like a cross between oilcloth and cellophane, Koffler said. The first time I saw it was when Pluto got the crypto machine you're going to take with you from the army. How many other people know about the Philippine operation?
McCoy interrupted, a tone of annoyance or exasperation in his voice.
I'm not going to discuss this with the ladies during morning tea, if that's what's concerning you, Lieutenant McCoy,
Daphne Koffler said. McCoy, embarrassed, raised both hands in a gesture of surrender.
Oh, that wasn't...
Steve thinks he's in the company of friends,
Daphne went on firmly, again reminding McCoy of Ernie,
who have the appropriate security clearances. And while his wife no longer has the appropriate clearances, he believes she can nevertheless be trusted to keep her mouth shut.
McCoy looked at her, but didn't reply.
"Especially since Steve wants very desperately to go with you," she added.
"What did she say? He wants desperately to go?"
I don't think that's likely," McCoy said.
"You must know, Lieutenant," Daphne said, "that my husband is a rather determined man."
"You need a radio operator," Koffler argued. "So far the General hasn't come up with anybody, and Pluto already showed me how to operate the crypto machine."
"For Christ's sake, why would you want to go with us?" McCoy asked.
The question obviously discomfited Koffler.
"You just got off of Buka. You just got out of the hospital," McCoy said, warming to his subject. "You just got married, for Christ's sake."
"That's why," Koffler said softly.
"What?"
"I have obligations now. Daphne and a family."
"And so you want to go running around in the Philippines, hiding from the Japs?"
"I want to be an officer," Koffler said.
McCoy looked at him long enough to see that he was serious, then breathed, "Oh, Jesus."
"Lieutenant Moore was a sergeant when he came here," Koffler said reasonably. "He went to Guadalcanal, came back, and they made him an officer. Moore is a college graduate. He's a Japanese linguist, a cryptographer, and he's 23 years old."
Koffler didn't choose to hear the reply.
"Lieutenant Hart came here as a sergeant," he went on. "He went to Buka with you, and when you came back, they made him a lieutenant," he argued.
"Hart is older than Moore," McCoy replied. "Before he came in the Corps, he was a detective. They made him an officer because it makes things easier for the general, not because..."
The absurdity of Koffler's reasoning and the determined look on his boyish face triggered something close to hilarity in McCoy's mind.
"Not because he fell heroically out of his little rubber boat trying to paddle ashore on Buka Island."
"How did you get your commission?" Koffler asked.
It was a challenge. "I went to officer candidate school at Quantico, as a matter of fact, with General Pickering's son, incidentally. We spent 6 months busting our ass..." "Excuse the language, Mrs. Koffler, to get that damn gold bar."
Koffler now looked hurt and embarrassed.
"You want to be an officer, apply for OCS, McCoy said reasonably. "I'm sure the general would recommend you for it. Hell, Koffler, I'll write you a letter of recommendation myself."
"I already looked into that. I can't even apply until I'm 21, for Christ's sake."
"Is that what the regulation says?" McCoy asked.
"Nobody asked me how old I was when I jumped onto Buka," Koffler said.
McCoy could think of no reply to make, and made none.
"Oh, hell," Koffler said,
as if finally accepting the logic of McCoy's argument.
"But I still want to go with you."
"Not if I have anything to say about it," McCoy thought.
"Koffler, give yourself a chance to get your health back. Enjoy your family. Remember that sacred Marine Corps saying, never volunteer for anything?"
"You volunteered to get Howard and me off Buka," Koffler argued.
"Jesus Christ! You don't know when to quit, do you?" McCoy snapped.
"For Christ's sake, Koffler, drop it!"
Koffler shrugged.
McCoy looked at Daphne Koffler in time to see that she didn't like at all the words or the tone of voice he had used on her husband.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Maybe it would be best if I left."
"That would just make things worse," she said. "And you didn't say anything to him I haven't already said. Please stay."
"Fix me another drink, Koffler," Lieutenant Hart said. "And then tell Lieutenant McCoy about plastic."
"Sure,"
Koffler said. McCoy met Daphne Koffler's eyes.
"Fix me one, too, while you're at it, please," he said.
She nodded her head, just perceptibly in approval. When her husband went into the kitchen, she walked to the couch and sat down beside McCoy.
"Thank you," she said.
"Excuse me?"
"You're wrong about me, Lieutenant," she said. "I married Steve because I love him, not because I'm carrying his child."
"Believe it or not, Mrs. Koffler, I'd already figured that out." She looked into his eyes again.
"You had, hadn't you?"
she said, as if surprised. He nodded.
"Now that we're all pals,"
George Hart said, "do you think you two could stop calling each other Mrs. Koffler and Lieutenant McCoy?" McCoy looked at him.
"Mr. Hart," McCoy said, "second lieutenants should be seen and not heard. Isn't that so, Daphne?"
I believe that's true, Ken, she replied.
Top Secret, Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Navy Department, Washington, D.C., via special channel. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. Eyes only, the Secretary of the Navy. Brisbane, Australia, Saturday, 14 November, 1942. Dear Frank, word just reached here that the battleships Washington and South Dakota have sunk the Japanese battleship Kirishima, even though the South Dakota apparently was pretty badly hit in the process. I'd like to think that Admiral Dan Callahan somehow knows about this. I was pretty upset when I heard he was killed the day before. Revenge is sweet. The more I get into this Fertig in the Philippines business, specifically, the more I have learned from Lieutenant Colonel Jack N.M.I. Stecker about the efficacy of a well-run guerrilla operation, the more I become convinced that it's worth a good deal of effort and expense. Where it stands right now is that a young Marine officer, Lieutenant Kenneth McCoy, whom they call Killer, by the way, just arrived here. He has already made the Makin Island Marine Raider operation and went ashore on Bukar from another submarine when we replaced the Marines there. He is as expert in rubber boat operations as they come. In other words, he sees no problem in getting ashore from a submarine off Mindanao. He and Stecker have come up with a list of material they feel should go to Fertig, essentially, and in this order, gold, radios, medicine, and small arms and ammunition. Because of the small stature of the average Filipino, both feel that the U.S. carbine is the proper weapon. I have the radios and the carbines and ammunition for them, and have been promised an array of medicines whenever I want them. I have also been promised a submarine, probably the USS Narwhal, which is a cargo submarine. The promise came from Sink Pak himself, who shares my belief that any guerrilla operation in the Philippines should be supported on strategic, tactical, and moral grounds. I only need two things more. I need $250,000 in gold. Actually, what I need is a cable transfer of that much money to the Bank of Australia, who will give me the gold. The sooner the better. The second thing I need is for you to goose the Marine Corps personnel people. They still haven't transferred Lieutenant Colonel Stecker to me. Colonel Rickaby reports that he's been getting a very cold shoulder about this, although no explanation has been given, and your normally incredibly able Captain Houghton hasn't been able to get them off their upholstered chairs either. I need Stecker for this. He's an expert in guerrilla operations, and this is certainly more important than what the Corps wants him to do vis-a-vis setting up prophylactic facilities and amateur theatricals. McCoy going ashore alone would not be nearly as effective as the two of them going together. I earnestly solicit your immediate action in this regard. Best regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General USMCR, Top Secret. Part 9. 1. Supreme Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, Brisbane, Australia, 17:15 hours, 16 November, 1942. The two Army military policemen on duty at the entrance of General MacArthur's headquarters saluted crisply as Brigadier General Fleming Pickering, USMCR, strode briskly through the door. Pickering returned their salute with a smile. He walked quickly to the Studebaker president with the letters USMC on each side of the hood and the Marine Corps insignia on its front doors, slid into the driver's seat, and started the engine. Second Lieutenant George F. Hart, USMCR, the aiguillette of his aide-de-camp status flapping up and down as he ran, slowed as he passed through the door long enough to exchange salutes with the MPs and then broke into a trot to the car as if afraid he would be left behind. As soon as Hart was in the car, the Studebaker, with a chirp of its tires, backed out of the reserved-for-general-officers parking space, stopped abruptly, and then, with another squeal of tires, drove away. The two MPs exchanged glances and small smiles. With the exception of the Marine General, every other general and admiral at Supreme Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, had an enlisted driver for his official vehicle.
The driver would jump out of the car when he spotted his general or admiral, open the rear door, stand at attention until the general or admiral had climbed in, close the door, and then, after making sure the aide-de-camp was in the back seat, get behind the wheel and chauffeur his august passenger in the ritual dignity to which he was entitled by virtue of his rank. Not so General Pickering. Not only did he normally drive himself, but more often than not, he wasn't accompanied by his aide-de-camp. There was more. It was reliably rumored that General Douglas MacArthur called General Pickering by his Christian name. Every other officer was addressed by his rank, except for a very few whom El Supremo honored by addressing them by their last names. This, and a number of other personal idiosyncrasies, General Pickering did not live, for example, in the quarters provided for the very senior officers, but in a rambling frame house he rented near the racetrack, had not, most of the enlisted men knew, endeared General Pickering to his peers, the other general and flag officers of Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO. It was, therefore, perhaps natural for the enlisted men, and many of the junior officers, to look fondly upon General Pickering. Anybody who had most of the big brass pissed off at him couldn't be all bad. "God damn the way these people think," General Pickering said, as he wheeled entirely too fast around a corner and headed toward the closed-for-the-duration racetrack. George Hart did not reply. He wasn't sure if he was being spoken to or whether General Pickering was thinking aloud, but a smile flickered across his lips. There was a silence of perhaps 30 seconds. "Fertig was a light colonel when Bataan fell," Pickering said. "Not a goddamned captain." Lieutenant Hart now deduced that whatever had put General Pickering in his current very pissed-off frame of mind concerned Wendell Fertig. Again, he elected not to reply. Pickering glanced over at Hart.
"That son of a bitch must have known that, George," he said reasonably, "and he should have told me."
"That son of a bitch," Lieutenant Hart correctly suspected, was Brigadier General Charles Willoughby, USA, MacArthur's G2, General Staff Officer, Intelligence.
"Yes, sir," Hart said. "How did you find out?"
"I ran into Phil Dupre," Pickering said. "He told me." Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Phil Dupre, who still wore the lapel insignia of the proud, now vanquished 26th Cavalry, it had been forced to eat its horses before the Philippines fell, had somehow escaped and was now one of MacArthur's staff officers. Hart met Dupre in Washington 3 months before, shortly after he went to work for General Pickering. Private George F. Hart, formerly Detective Hart of the St. Louis, Missouri Police Department, had been recruited from the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, Paris Island, to serve ostensibly as an orderly, but in fact as a bodyguard, to General Pickering, then recuperating from wounds and malaria in the Army's Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. Colonel Dupre, who had been sent to Washington as an officer courier from MacArthur's SWEPO headquarters, showed up in Pickering's hospital room bearing a personal letter from MacArthur congratulating Pickering on his promotion to Brigadier General. At the time, Hart was having more than a little trouble adjusting to the sudden changes in his life. One day he was just one more boot in a basic training platoon. Then he was summoned, late at night, to the bachelor officer's quarters, where a cold-eyed Marine first lieutenant, whom Hart correctly suspected was younger than he was, asked him rapid-fire but pertinent questions about his law enforcement background. Apparently satisfied with his answers and with Hart personally, he offered him an assignment as bodyguard to a General Pickering, adding that General Pickering didn't want a bodyguard. 2 days later, he was in Washington, still wearing his boots-shaven-head haircut, promoted sergeant, and living not in the Marine barracks, but in General Pickering's apartment in the Foster Lafayette Hotel, whose windows looked out across Pennsylvania Avenue onto the White House. Information was thrown rapidly at him. For instance, he learned that General Pickering was a reservist who had earned the nation's second-highest award for gallantry, the Distinguished Service Cross, as a teenaged enlisted man in France in the First World War, and that, in civilian life, he had been chairman of the board and chief executive officer of the Pacific and Far East Shipping Corporation. Hart had also learned that Pickering was not in the ordinary chain of command in the Marine Corps.
he reported directly to Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, and on a mission to the Pacific for Secretary Knox, not further described to Hart then, he had been on Guadalcanal, where he contracted malaria. Later, aboard a destroyer taking him from the island, he was wounded when the warship was strafed by a Japanese bomber. After her captain was killed, he earned the Silver Star for assuming command of the vessel despite his wounds. Hart had heard, of course, of the Marine raider attack on Makin Island, in which President Roosevelt's son participated, and after what he knew about General Pickering, he was not really surprised to find out that the cold-eyed lieutenant who had interviewed him at Paris Island had made the raid, nor even to find out that the lieutenant, who was, in fact, 3 years younger than he was 25, was the near-legendary Killer McCoy. At the time he met Colonel Dupré, Hart was devoutly following the advice of his father, Police Captain Carl J. Hart, that when you're involved in something you don't really understand, keep your eyes and ears open and your mouth shut. Thus, when Colonel Dupré came into General Pickering's hospital room, he fought like a cop, and not like a Marine Corps boot promoted far beyond his capabilities to sergeant. And as a cop, trained to read people, he recognized that Dupré and Pickering were kindred souls, and that they themselves were both aware of their kinship. When he came to Australia with General Pickering, he was not surprised that Colonel Dupré became one of the very small group of people unconnected with General Pickering's mission who were welcome at Water Lily Cottage. Not much surprised George F. Hart anymore. Not even when he found himself in a rubber boat with Killer McCoy paddling ashore onto the Japanese-held island of Buka, nor the gold bars on his collar when the other boots in his platoon at Paris Island were still hoping to make PFC. He was well aware that his promotion had to do with facilitating General Pickering's mission, and not with his being some kind of super marine. He was beginning to understand his role as a marine. In addition to the bodyguard role, it was to make himself as useful as he could to General Pickering. And he liked this role. He had some time ago realized that Pickering was special, and working for him a privilege. More than that, General Pickering was the only man in his life he admired as much as his father. Perhaps more than his father, as disloyal as this might sound. Pickering drove the Studebaker President past the boarded-up racetrack, turned right, and two blocks beyond turned off the street onto the clamshell-paved driveway of Water Lily Cottage. A Chevrolet pickup truck with Royal Australian Navy markings was among the vehicles pulled nose in against the porch of Water Lily Cottage. It belonged to Lieutenant Commander Eric A. Felt, R.A.N. Pickering had stopped the Studebaker, pulled on the parking brake, and was halfway up the steps of Water Lily Cottage before Lieutenant Hart could open his door. When Pickering walked into the room, Felt and Hahn were comfortably sprawled on the rattan furniture with which the cottage was furnished. Hahn started to get to his feet, but Pickering waved him back.
"I knew you wouldn't mind if we started without you, Pickering, old sod," Felt said, raising a glass dark with whiskey. "Particularly since I am the bearer of sad tidings."
"No sub?" Pickering asked, walking to a table holding a dozen or more bottles of liquor.
3 weeks is the best I could do," Felt said, "even begging on my knees. Sorry."
"Well, thanks for trying," Pickering said. "It was a long shot, anyway." He picked up a bottle of famous Grouse Scotch whiskey and poured an inch and a half into a glass. Then he turned to Hart.
"You want one of these, George?" he asked.
"No, thank you, sir. I've got the duty tonight." "That may be a blessing in disguise," Pickering said thoughtfully, obviously referring to the unavailability of an Australian submarine. "Nimitz may be able to lend us the Narwhal."
"The what?"
"The Navy has two transport submarines, underwater freighters, so to speak. One of them is the Narwhal. I don't know what they call the other one. If we can have it, we could take Fertig a lot more than we could carry on a regular sub."
"You think he'll be willing?" Felt asked.
"We'll soon find out," Pickering said. "Pluto, send Nimitz a special channel personal, saying we need the Narwhal, and where should we plan on rendezvousing with her?" He paused and added, thinking aloud, which means we'll probably have to fly them to Espiritu Santo. It would take too much time to bring the narwhal here, which in turn means I'm going to have to fight the Army Air Corps for several tons of space on their transports. Felt nodded.
Yes, sir,
Major Hahn said.
Would you like to see the message before it goes out?
I have a profound faith in your spelling, Pluto, Pickering said, smiling. But you better send an information copy to Houghton. I'm sure there are 30 admirals on Syncpak's staff with twice as many good reasons why Syncpak should not let us have the narwhal. I may have to go to Frank Knox about this, and Houghton should have forewarning.
Yes, sir, Pluto said. Houghton, but not Rickaby.
Ask Houghton to advise Rickaby, Pickering said, and then asked, Where are they? Major Hahn pointed to the rear of the cottage. Pickering took a healthy swallow of the whiskey, then set the glass down beside a row of empty glasses. He then immediately picked it and the empties up with the fingers of one hand. With the other, he grabbed the bottle of Famous Grouse by the neck. He walked out of the living room and down the corridor to a closed door and knocked on it with the whiskey bottle. Open up! He ordered. The door was opened by Staff Sergeant Steve Koffler. It's the cocktail hour, Pickering said. Didn't anyone notice? He handed the Famous Grouse to Koffler and walked to a table in the middle of the room and set the glasses on it. Lieutenant Colonel Jack N.M.I. Stecker and First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy were sitting at the table, their uniforms protected by flower-patterned aprons, obviously borrowed from the kitchen. The table held three small rifles, technically U.S. carbines, caliber 30 M1, broken down. Pickering saw their trigger group assemblies were also in pieces. When you can part with that adorable apron, Jack, Pickering said, stick these in your pocket. He tossed a small cellophane-covered package onto the table. It contained two silver eagles, the insignia of a colonel.
That's, little premature, isn't it? Lieutenant Colonel Stecker asked, a little uncomfortably.
The Secretary of the Navy told me, I told General MacArthur, and tomorrow morning at 0845 with suitable ceremony, El Supremo will pin those on you. Stecker shook his head.
That really wasn't necessary, Stecker said.
There will be a photographer, Pickering went on. Ellie will soon have a picture of her husband, the Colonel, with El Supremo beaming at him with which to dazzle her neighbors. Ellie was Mrs. Jack N.M.I. Stecker.
I suppose, Colonel Stecker said, reaching for the bottle of whiskey, that it would be bad manners if I were to say I wish to hell the General had minded his own business.
I suppose you've heard the bad news? No Aussie sub? Pickering asked.
Felt told us,
Stecker said. He held the bottle over one of the glasses and asked with a gesture if Lieutenant McCoy wanted him to pour. McCoy held up fingers indicating that he wanted about an inch and a half.
Thank you, sir, he said. And will Mrs. Koffler banish you from the marriage bed if you come home smelling of this?
Stecker asked Sergeant Koffler.
I've got some sense, sir, Koffler said. A little one, please.
Now that you've taken those apart, can you put them back together again? Pickering asked, indicating the carbines. What are you doing, anyway?
Working on the sears, Stecker said.
Pickering was aware that the carbines were almost certainly in perfect functioning order as they came out of their crates, but he was not at all surprised that Stecker and McCoy felt it necessary to fine-tune them. They were not only Marines, nor even only Marine marksmen. Both had drawn extra pay as enlisted men for being expert riflemen, but weapons experts.
I think we can get them back together, General, McCoy said.
And if the Colonel can't, Sergeant Koffler can. Stecker chuckled. And you're determined that's what you want to take with you? Pickering asked.
I'd rather take a Garand, McCoy said. I thought I'd explained why you should take the carbines, Stecker said.
That's not what the General asked, Colonel, McCoy said, smiling at Stecker. The General asked me what I'd rather take. I will take one of these, but I'd rather take a Garand.
He was a sea lawyer the first time I ever met him, Stecker said, smiling at Pickering. Wise-ass little China Marine corporal in a handmade uniform. Knew everything. Had expert medals pinned all over him.
but when he went on the KD range, he couldn't hit anything but the butts. It looked like a Chinese fire drill with all those Maggie's drawers flying.
The KD range was the known distance small arms range, while Maggie's drawers was a red flag waved from the target butts to signal a complete miss.
Christ, McCoy chuckled. I forgot about that. Until I figured out what that bastard was doing to me, I thought I was losing my mind.
Until what bastard was doing what to you? Pickering asked.
General, Stecker said, I know you'll find this hard to believe, but there were a number of officers who didn't think Corporal McCoy should be an officer and a gentleman.
There was a Master Gunny who didn't think so either, as I remember it, McCoy said.
Before being called to active duty as a reserve officer, Stecker was the senior master gunnery sergeant at Marine Base, Quantico, Virginia.
I didn't say that, Stecker said. I said that if by some miracle you got through OCS, you would probably be the worst officer in the history of the Corps. And time seems to have proved me right.
Are you two going to explain what you're talking about? Pickering said.
As I was saying, General, before this impertinent sea lawyer interrupted me, Stecker said, there was a lieutenant who was sent right up the wall by the prospect of this young man putting on an officer's uniform. Macklin, McCoy interrupted. Robert B. Macklin. That was the son of a bitch's name.
That's the man, Stecker said.
What happened, General, was that he tried to get the sea lawyer here kicked out of OCS.
Why? Pickering asked.
I had a run-in with him in China, McCoy said, when I was working for Ed Banning. He was... is, if he's still alive, and I suppose it's too much to hope that he isn't, a miserable, lying son of a bitch. Banning wrote him an efficiency report that should have gotten him kicked out of the Corps, and would have, if the war hadn't come along.
Whatever happened in China, if Ed Banning sided with McCoy, the officer in question was dead wrong, Pickering decided. Stecker saw the confusion on Pickering's face.
I didn't know any of this at the time, he explained, Ken being too proud or too dumb to ask for help. What was I supposed to say? Gunny, this lieutenant doesn't like me and is being mean to me?
Yeah, Stecker said, exactly. That's exactly what you should have done, and told me why he didn't like you.
You would have laughed me right out of your office, McCoy said. Anyway, Stecker said, I heard that McCoy wasn't qualifying on the KD range. That didn't seem right, so I went and had a look and found this Lieutenant Macklin in the pits, scoring McCoy's targets himself. He was scoring every third shot as a Maggie's drawers. Then I did some snooping around and got the rest of the story.
In other words, General, McCoy said, if it wasn't for the gunny here sticking his nose in where it didn't belong, I would now be a buck sergeant in some nice, safe mess kit repair platoon somewhere.
Instead of getting ready for the third time to climb into a rubber boat and paddle it ashore from a submarine onto a Japanese-held island, first the Makin Island raid, then Buka to get Howard and Koffler out, and now the Philippines, Pickering thought.
There's a word for someone like you, Lieutenant, Stecker said. It's spelled ungrateful son of a bitch. I didn't think full bull colonels, Colonel, were supposed to swear at innocent junior officers like me, McCoy said piously.
Speaking of sons of bitches, Pickering said, having decided that it was time to get to what he'd come to tell McCoy. He waited until both Stecker and McCoy were looking at him, and then went on. I ran into Phil Dupre, he said, and learned from him that Fertig is a light bird, or was, before he promoted himself.
How does that make Phil a son of a bitch? Stecker asked.
The son of a bitch is the unnamed brigadier general army type on El Supremo's staff who certainly knew this and elected not to tell me.
Why not, General? McCoy asked.
Aside from his being an all-around son of a bitch, you mean?
Here's what I'm thinking. For one thing, Fertig, who came on active duty as a captain, was twice promoted for outstanding performance.
By whom? If not by El Supremo himself, then by somebody high up in the palace guard. Two promotions in what, 6 months? Means that he was doing an outstanding job.
McCoy nodded and made a motion of his hand toward Colonel Stecker.
The meaning was obvious. Here's the